Side 3, The Way of Zen, continuing on page 67. It must therefore be repeated that the negations apply not to reality itself, but to our ideas of reality. The positive and creative content of the Sunyavada is not in the philosophy itself, but in the new vision of reality which is revealed when its work is done. And Nagarjuna does not spoil this vision by trying to describe it. The Mahayana does, however, have another term for reality, which is perhaps rather more indicative than sunya, the void. This is the word tathata, which we may translate as suchness, thusness, or thatness. Similarly, the Buddhas are called tathagatas, they who go or come thus. The Sanskrit word tat, our that, is probably based on a child's first efforts at speech, when it points at something and says ta or da. Fathers flatter themselves by imagining that the child is calling them by name, dada or daddy. But perhaps the child is just expressing its recognition of the world and saying that. When we say just that or thus, we are pointing to the realm of nonverbal experience, to reality as we perceive it directly, for we are trying to indicate what we see or feel rather than what we think or say. Tathata, therefore, indicates the world just as it is, unscreened and undivided by the symbols and definitions of thought. It points to the concrete and actual as distinct from the abstract and conceptual. A Buddha is a tathagata, a thus-goer, because he is awakened to this primary non-conceptual world which no words can convey, and does not confuse it with such ideas as being or non-being, good or bad, past or future, here or there, moving or still, permanent or impermanent. As the Bodhisattva Manjushri speaks of the Tathagata in the Saptasatika, suchness, Tathata, neither becomes nor ceases to become. Thus do I see the Tathagata. Suchness does not stand at any point or place. Thus do I see the Tathagata. Suchness is neither past, future, nor present. Thus do I see the Tathagata. Suchness does not arise from the dual or the non-dual. Thus do I see the Tathagata. Suchness is neither impure nor pure. Thus do I see the Tathagata. Suchness neither arises nor comes to an end. Thus do I see the Tathagata. Note, suchness is neither past, future, nor present, for when it is seen that there is neither past nor future, there is no more a present, since the idea of the present has meaning only in relation to past and future. End of note. Because Tathata is the true state of a Buddha and of all beings whatsoever, it is also referred to as our true or original nature, and thus our Buddha nature. One of the cardinal doctrines of the Mahayana is that all beings are endowed with Buddha nature, and so have the possibility of becoming Buddhas. Because of the identity of Buddha nature and Tathata, the term Buddha is frequently used of reality itself, and not just of the awakened man. It so comes about that in the Mahayana, a Buddha is often seen as a personification of reality, forming the basis of those popular cults in which the Buddhas seem to be worshipped as gods. I say seem to be, because even Mahayana Buddhism is no real equivalent of Judeo-Christian theism, with its strict identification of God with a moral principle. Furthermore, the various Buddhas who are so venerated, Amitabha, Vairocana, Amitayus, Ratnasambhava, etc., are always personifications of one's own true nature. Here too lies the basis of the Buddhism of faith, of the Sukhavati, or Pure Land school, in which it is held that all efforts to become a Buddha are merely the false pride of the ego. All that is necessary is to repeat the formula Namo Amitabhaya, literally, the name of Amitabha, or Hail Amitabha, in the faith that this alone is sufficient to bring about one's rebirth in the pure land over which Amitabha presides. In this pure land, all the obstacles which stand in the way of becoming a Buddha in this world are removed, so that rebirth in the pure land is virtually equivalent to becoming a Buddha. The repetition of the name is held to be effective because in ages past, Amitabha vowed that he would not enter into supreme Buddhahood unless rebirth in the Pure Land were assured for all beings who invoked his name. Because he subsequently entered the state of Buddhahood, the vow is effectively fulfilled. Even Nagarjuna was in sympathy with this doctrine, for it is obviously a popular and more graphic way of saying that since one's own true nature is already the Buddha nature, one does not have to do anything to make it so. On the contrary, to seek to become Buddha is to deny that one is already Buddha. And this is the sole basis upon which Buddhahood can be realized. In short, to become a Buddha, it is only necessary to have the faith that one is a Buddha already. Shinran, the great Japanese exponent of the Pure Land, went even so far as to say that it was only necessary to repeat the name, for he saw that the attempt to make an act of faith was too artificial and led one to doubt one's own faith. Pure Land Buddhism is clearly an outgrowth of the Bodhisattva doctrine that the proper work of the liberated man is the liberation of all other beings by upaya, or skillful means. By prajna, or intuitive wisdom, he sees into the nature of reality, and this in turn awakens karuna, or compassion for all who are still in the bonds of ignorance. At its deepest level, karuna means something rather more than compassion for the ignorance of others, for we saw that the Bodhisattva's return into the world of samsara was based on the principle that samsara is in fact nirvana, and that the void is precisely form. If prajna is to see that form is void, karuna is to see that the void is form. It is therefore an affirmation of the everyday world in its natural suchness, and this is one of the features of the Mahayana most strongly emphasized in Zen. Indeed, it makes nonsense of the idea that Buddhism is always a philosophy of world denial, in which the uniqueness of forms has no importance. It was because of karuna that Mahayana Buddhism became the principal inspiration of Chinese art in the Sung and Yuan dynasties, an art which stressed natural forms rather than religious symbols. For by karuna, it is seen that the dissolution of forms into the void is in no way different from the particular characteristics of the forms themselves. The life of things is only conventionally separable from their death. In reality, the dying is the living. The perception that each single form, just as it is the void, and that, further, the uniqueness of each form arises from the fact that it exists in relation to every other form, is the basis of the Dharma Dhatu, Dharma realm, doctrine of the enormous Avatamsaka Sutra. This voluminous work is probably the final culmination of Indian Mahayana, and one of its central images is a vast network of gems or crystals, like a spider's web at dawn, in which each gem reflects all the others. This net of gems is the Dharma Dhatu, the universe, the realm of innumerable dharmas, or thing events. Chinese commentators worked out a fourfold classification of the Dharma Dhatu, which became of considerable importance for Zen late in the Tang dynasty. Their classification of the four Dharma realms was as follows. 1. Shi, the unique individual thing events of which the universe is composed. 2. Li, the principle or ultimate reality underlying the multiplicity of things. 3. Li Xia Wu Ai, between principle and thing, no obstruction, which is to say that there is no incompatibility between nirvana and samsara, void and form. The attainment of the one does not involve the annihilation of the other. 4. Xia Xia Wu Ai, between thing and thing, no obstruction, which is to say that each thing event involves every other, and that the highest insight is simply the perception of them in their natural suchness. At this level, every thing event is seen to be self-determinative, self-generating, or spontaneous, for to be quite naturally what it is, to be tattha, just thus, is to be free and without obstruction. The doctrine of the Dharma Dhatu is approximately that the proper harmony of the universe is realized when each thing event is allowed to be freely and spontaneously itself, without interference. Stated more subjectively, it is saying, let everything be free to be just as it is. Do not separate yourself from the world and try to order it around. There is a subtle distinction between this and mere laissez-faire, which may be suggested by the way in which we move our various limbs. Each one moves by itself from within. To walk, we do not pick up our feet with our hands. The individual body is therefore a system of shesha wu ai. And the Buddha realizes that the whole universe is his body, a marvelously interrelated harmony organized from within itself rather than by interference from outside. Mahayana philosophy thinks of the Buddha's body as threefold, as the trikaya, or triple body. His body considered either as the multitude of thing events or as his particular human forms is termed the nirmanakaya, or body of transformation. The particular human forms are such historic and prehistoric Buddhas as Gautama, Kasyapa, or Kanakamuni. And since these appear in the flesh, the nirmanakaya includes, in principle, the entire universe of form. There is next the sambhogakaya, or body of enjoyment. This is the sphere of prajna, wisdom, and karuna, compassion. The latter looking down to the world of form, and the former looking up to the realm of the void. Sambhogakaya might also be called the body of realization, since it is in this body that a Buddha realizes that he is a Buddha. Finally, there is the Dharmakaya, the Dharma body, which is the void, the sunya itself. Nagarjuna did not discuss the way in which the void appears as form, the Dharmakaya as the Nirmanakaya, feeling perhaps that this would be completely unintelligible to those who had not actually realized awakening. For the Buddha himself had compared such inquiries to the foolishness of a man shot with an arrow, who would not permit it to be taken out of his flesh until he had been told all the details of his assailant's appearance, family, and motivation. Nevertheless, Nagarjuna's successors, the brothers Asanga and Vasubandhu, circa 280 to 360, who worked out the type of Mahayana philosophy generally known as Yogacara, made some attempt to discuss this particular problem. According to the Yogacara, the world of form is citta-matra, mind only, or vijñapti-matra, representation only. This view seems to have a very close resemblance to Western philosophies of subjective idealism, in which the external and material world is regarded as a projection of the mind. However, there seem to be some differences between the two points of view. Here, as always, the Mahayana is not so much a theoretical and speculative construction as an account of an inner experience and a means of awakening the experience in others. Furthermore, the word citta is not precisely equivalent to our mind. Western thought tends to define mind by opposition to matter, and to consider matter not so much as measure as the solid stuff which is measured. Measure itself, abstraction, is for the West more of the nature of mind, since we tend to think of mind and spirit as more abstract than concrete. But in Buddhist philosophy, citta does not stand over against a conception of solid stuff. The world has never been considered in terms of a primary substance shaped into various forms by the action of mind or spirit. Such an image is not in the history of Buddhist thought, and thus the problem of how impalpable mind can influence solid matter has never arisen. Wherever we should speak of the material or physical or substantial world, Buddhism employs the term rupa, which is not so much our matter as form. There is no material substance underlying rupa, unless it be citta itself. The difficulty of making equations and comparisons between Eastern and Western ideas is that the two worlds do not start with the same assumptions and premises. They do not have the same basic categorizations of experience. When, therefore, the world has never been divided into mind and matter, but rather into mind and form, the word mind cannot mean quite the same thing in both instances. The word man, for example, does not have quite the same meaning when contrasted with woman as when contrasted with animal. A simplified and somewhat rough way of stating the difference is that Western idealists have begun to philosophize from a world consisting of mind or spirit, form, and matter, whereas the Buddhists have begun to philosophize from a world of mind and form. The Yogacara does not, therefore, discuss the relation of forms of matter to mind. It discusses the relation of forms to mind and concludes that they are forms of mind. As a result, the term mind, citta, becomes logically meaningless. But because the main concern of Buddhism is with a realm of experience which is non-logical and meaningless, in the sense that it does not symbolize or signify anything other than itself, there is no objection to meaningless terms. From the logical standpoint, the proposition, everything is mind, says no more than that everything is everything. For if there is nothing which is not mind, the word belongs to no class and has no limits, no definition. One might as well use blah, which is almost exactly what Buddhism does with the nonsense word tatata. For the function of these nonsense terms is to draw our attention to the fact that logic and meaning, with its inherent duality, is a property of thought and language, but not of the actual world. The nonverbal concrete world contains no classes and no symbols which signify or mean anything other than themselves. Consequently, it contains no duality. For duality arises only when we classify, when we sort our experiences into mental boxes. Since a box is no box without an inside and an outside. Mental boxes are probably formed in our minds long before formal thought and language supply labels to identify them. We have begun to classify as soon as we notice differences, regularities and irregularities, as soon as we make associations of any kind. But if the word mental means anything at all, this act of classification is certainly mental. For to notice differences and to associate them with one another is something more than simply to respond to sense contacts. Yet if classes are a product of the mind, of noticing, association, thought and language, the world, considered simply as all classes of objects, is a product of the mind. This is, I think, what the Yogacara means by the assertion that the world is mind only, citta matram lokam. It means that external and internal, before and after, heavy and light, pleasant and painful, moving and still, are all ideas or mental classifications. Their relation to the concrete world is the same as that of words. Thus the world that we know, when understood as the world as classified, is a product of the mind, and as the sound water is not actually water, the classified world is not the real world. The problem of what the mind is can now be seen to be the same as the problem of what the real world is. It cannot be answered, for every what is a class, and we cannot classify the classifier. Is it not then merely absurd to speak of the mind, the citta, at all, if there is no way of saying what it is? On the contrary, the mathematician Kurt Gödel has given us a rigorous proof of the fact that every logical system must contain a premise which it cannot define without contradicting itself. The Yogacara takes citta as its premise and does not define it, since citta is here the equivalent of sunya and tathata. For the mind, quote, is beyond all philosophical views. It is apart from discrimination. It is not attainable, nor is it ever born. I say there is nothing but mind. It is not an existence, nor is it a non-existence. It is indeed beyond both existence and non-existence. Out of mind spring innumerable things, conditioned by discrimination, that is, classification, and habit energy. These things people accept as an external world. What appears to be external does not exist in reality. It is indeed mind that is seen as multiplicity. The body, property, and abode, all these, I say, are nothing but mind. Note. From the Lankavatara Sutra. I have cited the Lankavatara for both Madhyamika and Yogacara viewpoints, since either both schools have used the sutra, or else it is a work of the latter, incorporating views of the former. Since historical order is here a matter of conjecture, I have simply chosen sources which seem to express the ideas in question most effectively. End of note. Within this undefined continuum of citta, The Yogacara describes 8 kinds of Vijnana, or discriminating consciousness. There is a consciousness appropriate to each of the 5 senses. There is the 6th sense consciousness, Manovijnana, unifying the other 5 so that what is touched or heard may be related to what is seen. There is Manas, center of the mind's discriminative and classifying activity. And finally, there is the store consciousness, Alaya Vijnana, the supra-individual mind, which contains the seeds of all possible forms. The store consciousness is almost equivalent to the citta itself and is supra-individual because it stands prior to every differentiation. It is not to be conceived as a sort of ghostly gas permeating all beings, since space and extension are likewise here only in potentiality. In other words, the store consciousness is that from which the formal world arises spontaneously or playfully, vikridita. For the Mahayana does not make the mistake of trying to account for the production of the world from the mind by a series of necessary causes. Whatever is linked by causal necessity is of the world of Maya, not beyond it. Speaking somewhat poetically, the world illusion comes out of the great void for no reason, purposelessly, and just because there is no necessity for it to do so. For the activity of the void is playful, or vikridita, because it is not motivated action, karma. Thus, as the Yogacara describes it, the production of the formal world arises spontaneously from the store consciousness, flows up into the manas, where the primordial differentiations are made, passes thence into the 6 sense consciousnesses, which in turn produce the sense organs, or gates, ayatana, through which it finally projects the classified external world. The Buddhist yoga, therefore, consists in reversing the process, in stilling the discriminative activity of the mind, and letting the categories of Maya fall back into potentiality, so that the world may be seen in its unclassified suchness. Here Karuna awakens, and the Bodhisattva lets the projection arise again, having become consciously identified with the playful and purposeless character of the void. Chapter 4, The Rise and Development of Zen. The qualities which distinguish Zen or Chan from other types of Buddhism are rather elusive when it comes to putting them in words. Yet Zen has a definite and unmistakable flavor. Although the name Zen is dhyana, or meditation, other schools of Buddhism emphasize meditation as much as, if not more, than Zen, and at times it seems as if the practice of formal meditation were not necessary to Zen at all. Nor is Zen peculiar in having nothing to say, in insisting that the truth cannot be put into words, for this is already the Madhyamika, as well as the teaching of Lao Tzu. Those who know do not speak. Those who speak do not know. Perhaps the special flavor of Zen is best described as a certain directness. In other schools of Buddhism, awakening or bodhi seems remote and almost superhuman, something to be reached only after many lives of patient effort. But in Zen there is always the feeling that awakening is something quite natural, something startlingly obvious, which may occur at any moment. If it involves a difficulty, it is just that it is much too simple. Zen is also direct in its way of teaching, for it points directly and openly to the truth, and does not trifle with symbolism. Direct pointing, jiju, is the open demonstration of Zen by non-symbolic actions or words, which usually appear to the uninitiated as having to do with the most ordinary secular affairs, or to be completely crazy. In answer to a question about Buddhism, the master makes a casual remark about the weather, or performs some simple action which seems to have nothing to do with philosophical or spiritual matters. However, it is difficult to find many instances of this method before the middle of the Tang dynasty, by which time Zen was already well established. But it is certainly consistent with the emphasis of the earlier masters on immediate awakening in the midst of everyday affairs. No one has been able to find any trace of a specific dhyana school in Indian Buddhism, though because of our lack of historical materials, this is no evidence that it did not exist. If the characteristic note of Zen is immediate or instantaneous awakening, dun wu, without passing through preparatory stages, there are certainly evidences of this principle in India. The Lankavatara Sutra states that there are both gradual and sudden yugapat ways of awakening, the former by purification of the tainted outflows or projections, ashrava, of the mind, and the latter by paravritti, an instantaneous turning about within the depths of consciousness, whereby dualistic views are cast off. It is likened to a mirror immediately reflecting whatever forms and images appear before it. There is, too, a clear connection between the idea of immediate awakening and the teaching of the Vajracchedika, or Diamond Cutter Sutra, on the fact that to attain awakening is not to attain anything. In other words, if nirvana is actually here and now, so that to seek it is to lose it, a realization through progressive stages is hardly appropriate. One would have to see into it in the present moment, directly. Although its origins are probably later than those of Zen in China, there is also a tradition of this kind in Tantric Buddhism, and there is nothing to indicate that there was a reverse influence from Chinese Zen. Parallels to Zen sayings may be seen in a 10th century Tantric work by Saraha. If it, the truth, is already manifest, what's the use of meditation? And if it is hidden, one is just measuring darkness. Mantras and tantras, meditation and concentration, they are all a cause of self-deception. Do not defile in contemplation thought that is pure in its own nature, but abide in the bliss of yourself and cease those torments. Whatever you see, that is it. In front, behind, in all the 10 directions. Even today, let your master make an end of delusion. The nature of the sky is originally clear, but by gazing and gazing, the sight becomes obscured. From Saraha's Treasury of Songs, translated by David Snellgrove. Tibetan Buddhism, likewise, comprises a tradition of the short path, considered as a swift and steep ascent to nirvana for those who have the necessary courage, though a doctrine more suggestive of the Zen emphasis on immediacy and naturalness is found in the 6 precepts of Tilopa. No thought, no reflection, no analysis, no cultivation, no intention. Let it settle itself. Immediate release without any special contrivance or intention is also implied in the tantric idea of sahaja, the easy or natural state of the liberated sage. This is not the place to discuss the real meaning of immediate awakening and naturalness, but these instances are cited to show that the tradition of a direct path existed outside China, suggesting some original source in Indian Buddhism. An obvious reason for the lack of materials would be that a principle of this kind, so easily open to misinterpretation, might have been kept as a secret doctrine, discussed openly only in later times. Zen tradition does indeed maintain that immediate awakening is not communicated by the sutras, but has been passed down directly from master to pupil. This does not necessarily imply anything so esoteric as an experience conveyed by telepathy, but something much less sensational. Thus, when Hindu pundits insist that wisdom is not to be gained from the scriptures but only from a teacher or guru, it means that the actual texts, such as the Yoga Sutra, contain only the headings of the doctrine, and that its full explanation requires someone who has learned the oral tradition. To this it should hardly be necessary to add that since the tradition is primarily an experience, words can communicate it no more and no less than any other experience. However, it is not really necessary to suppose that there was ever a specific Dhyana school in India. The creation of Zen would seem to be sufficiently explained by the exposure of Taoists and Confucians to the main principles of Mahayana Buddhism. Therefore, the appearance of trends very close to Zen can be seen almost as soon as the great Mahayana Sutras became available in China, that is to say, with the work of the great Indian scholar-monk Kumarajiva. Kumarajiva was translating the sutras in Kudzang and Chang'an between 384 and 413, at which time one of his outstanding students was the young monk Seng Zhao, 384 to 414, who had started out in life as a copyist of the Confucian and Taoist texts. Seng Zhao had been converted to Buddhism as a result of reading the Vimalakirti Sutra, a text which has exercised considerable influence upon Zen. Although Seng Zhao became a monk, this sutra is the story of a layman, Vimalakirti, who excelled all the Buddha's disciples in the depth of his understanding. He had surpassed all the other disciples and bodhisattvas by answering a question as to the nature of the non-dual reality with a thunderous silence, an example frequently followed by Zen masters. Vimalakirti, thunderingly silent, is, too, a favorite theme of Zen artists. But the main importance of this sutra for China and for Zen was the point that perfect awakening was consistent with the affairs of everyday life, and that indeed the highest attainment was to enter into awakening without exterminating the defilements, klesa. There was an appeal here to both the Confucian and the Taoist mentality. The Confucian stress on the importance of family life would not easily sympathize with the rigorously monastic type of Buddhism. Though the Chinese Buddhist masters were normally monks, they had large numbers of advanced lay students, and Zen in particular has always attached great importance to the expression of Buddhism in formally secular terms, in arts of every type, in manual labor, and in appreciation of the natural universe. Confucian and Taoist alike would be especially agreeable to the idea of an awakening which did not involve the extermination of human passions, as klesa may also be translated. We have already noted the peculiar trust in human nature which both these philosophies professed. However, not exterminating the passions does not mean letting them flourish untamed. It means letting go of them rather than fighting them, neither repressing passion nor indulging it. For the Taoist is never violent, since he achieves his ends by non-interference, wu wei, which is a kind of psychological judo. Seng Zhao's writings, as well as his commentary on the Vimalakirti Sutra, are full of Taoist quotations and phrases, for he seemed to be following the example of less important, though earlier monks, such as Hui Yuan, 334-416, and Dao An, 312-385, in using extension of the idea Go Yi for explaining Buddhism through Taoist parallels. So much did this suggest an equivalence between the two traditions that by the end of the 5th century, Liu Chu could say, from the Kunlun Mountains eastward, the Taoist term Great Oneness is used. From Kashmir westward, the Buddhist term Sambodhi is used. Whether one looks longingly toward non-being, Wu, or cultivates emptiness, sunyata, the principle involved is the same. Two of Seng Zhao's doctrines would seem to have had some importance for the later development of Zen, his view of time and change, and his idea that prajna is not knowledge. The chapter on the immutability of things in his book of Zhao is so original and so startlingly similar to the section on time in the first volume of Dogen's Shobogenzo that the celebrated Japanese Zen philosopher can hardly have been unfamiliar with it. Quote, past things are in the past, and do not go there from the present, and present things are in the present, and do not go there from the past. Rivers which compete with one another to inundate the land do not flow. The wandering air that blows about is not moving. The sun and moon, revolving in their orbits, do not turn around. Translated by Liebenthal. In the same way, Dogen pointed out that firewood does not become ashes and life does not become death, just as the winter does not become the spring. Every moment of time is self-contained and quiescent. Note, the same idea was used even before Dogen by the Zen master Matsu, died 788. Quote, so with former thoughts, later thoughts, and thoughts in between. The thoughts follow one another without being linked together. Each one is absolutely tranquil. End of note. Seng Zhao also discussed the seeming paradox that prajna is a kind of ignorance. Because the ultimate reality has no qualities, and is not a thing, it cannot become an object of knowledge. Therefore, prajna, direct insight, knows the truth by not knowing. Quote, wisdom knows not, yet it illumines the deepest profundity. Spirit calculates not, yet it responds to the necessities of the given moment. Because it calculates not, spirit shines in lonely glory in what is beyond the world. Because it knows not, wisdom illumines the mystery, shuan, beyond mundane affairs. Yet though wisdom lies outside affairs, it never lacks them. Though spirit lies beyond the world, it stays ever within it. Translated by Lieventhal. Here is the main links between Taoism and Zen. For the style and terminology of the Book of Zhao is Taoist throughout, though the subject matter is Buddhist. The sayings of the early Zen masters, such as Wei Neng, Shen Wei, and Wang Bo, are full of these very ideas, that truly to know is not to know, that the awakened mind responds immediately without calculation, and that there is no incompatibility between Buddhahood and the everyday life of the world. Even closer to the standpoint of Zen was Seng Zhao's fellow student, Dao Sheng, 360-434, the first clear and unequivocal exponent of the doctrine of instantaneous awakening. If nirvana is not to be found by grasping, there can be no question of approaching it by stages, by the slow process of the accumulation of knowledge. It must be realized in a single flash of insight, which is dunwu, or in Japanese, satori, the familiar Zen term for sudden awakening. Xie Lingyun, in his discussion of Dao Sheng's doctrine, even suggests that instantaneous awakening is more appropriate to the Chinese mentality than to the Indian, and lends weight to Suzuki's description of Zen as the Chinese revolution against Indian Buddhism. Dao Sheng's doctrine, however unusual and startling, must have found considerable acceptance. It is mentioned again more than a century later in a work by Wei Yuan, 523-592, who also associates it with the master Hui Dan, who lived until about 627. The importance of these early precursors of Zen is that they provide a clue to the historical beginnings of the movement, if we cannot accept the traditional story that it arrived in China in 520 with the Indian monk Bodhidharma. Modern scholars such as Fung Yulan and Peiyo have cast serious doubts upon the truth of this tradition. They suggest that the Bodhidharma story was a pious invention of later times, when the Zen school needed historical authority for its claim to be a direct transmission of experience from the Buddha himself outside the sutras. For Bodhidharma is represented as the 28th of a somewhat fanciful list of Indian patriarchs, standing in a direct line of apostolic succession from Gautama. Note, Hu Shi and Tang Yongting have suggested that Bodhidharma was in China at the earlier date of 420-479. End of note. At this stage of the inquiry, it is hard to say whether the views of these scholars are to be taken seriously, or whether they are but another instance of an academic fashion for casting doubt upon the historicity of religious founders. The traditional story which the Zen school gives of its own origin is that Bodhidharma arrived in Canton from India around the year 520, and proceeded to the court of the Emperor Wu of Yang, an enthusiastic patron of Buddhism. However, Bodhidharma's doctrine and his abrupt attitude did not appeal to the emperor, so that he withdrew for some years to a monastery in the state of Wei, and spent his time gazing at the wall until at last he found a suitable disciple in Wei Ko, who subsequently became the second patriarch of Zen in China. There is, of course, nothing improbable in the arrival of a great Buddhist master from India at this period. Kumarajiva had arrived shortly before 400, Bodhiruchi just after 500, and Paramatta was at the court of Liang about the same time as Bodhidharma. Is it really surprising that there should be no surviving record of his existence until little more than 100 years after his time? These were not the days of newspapers and who's who's, and even in our own excessively documented times, people with important contributions to our knowledge and culture can remain unrecognized and unrecorded until years after their death. Here again, it seems that we may as well accept the story of Bodhidharma until there is some really overwhelming evidence against it, recognizing that the ideas of Zheng Chao, Dao Sheng, and others could also have been tributaries to the stream of Zen. One of the reasons for suspecting the Bodhidharma story is that Zen is so Chinese in style that an Indian origin seems improbable. Yet the very Taoistic Zheng Zhao was a pupil of Kumarajiva, as was Dao Sheng, and the writings attributed to Bodhidharma and his successors until Hui Neng, 638-713, show the clear transition from an Indian to a Chinese view of dhyana. The absence of any record of a dhyana school in Indian Buddhist literature, or of Bodhidharma in connection with it, is perhaps due to the fact that there never was any dhyana or Zen school even in China until some 200 years after Bodhidharma's time. On the other hand, there would have been an almost universal practice of dhyana, that is, Dzogchen, Japanese Zazen or sitting meditation, among Buddhist monks, and the special instructors who supervised this practice were called dhyana masters, no matter what their school or sect. There were likewise Vinaya masters, or instructors in monastic discipline, and Dharma masters, or instructors in doctrine. Zen became a distinct school only as it promulgated a view of dhyana, which differed sharply from the generally accepted practice. Note, Hui Neng's Dan Qing, for example, records several instances of the sixth patriarch's interviews with dhyana masters who obviously did not belong to his own southern school of dhyana. Furthermore, it was not until the time of Bozhang, 720-814, or even later, that the Zen school had monasteries of its own. End of note. Zen tradition represents Bodhidharma as a fierce-looking fellow with a bushy beard and wide-open, penetrating eyes, in which, however, there is just a hint of a twinkle. A legend says that he once fell asleep in meditation and was so furious that he cut off his eyelids, and falling to the ground, they arose as the first tea plant. Tea has thereafter supplied Zen monks with a protection against sleep, and so clarifies and invigorates the mind that it has been said, the taste of Zen, Chan, and the taste of tea, Cha, are the same. Another legend holds that Bodhidharma sat so long in meditation that his legs fell off. Hence the delightful symbolism of those Japanese Dharma dolls, which represent Bodhidharma as a legless roly-poly, so weighted inside that he always stands up again when pushed over. A popular Japanese poem says of the Dharma doll, Jinsei nana korobi yaoki. Such is life, seven times down, eight times up. Bodhidharma's alleged interview with the Emperor Wu of Liang is typical of his abrupt and direct manner. For the Emperor described all that he had done to promote the practice of Buddhism and asked what merit he had gained thereby, taking the popular view that Buddhism is a gradual accumulation of merit through good deeds leading to better and better circumstances in future lives and finally to nirvana. But Bodhidharma replied, no merit whatever. This so undermined the emperor's idea of Buddhism that he asked, what then is the sacred doctrine's first principle? Bodhidharma replied, it's just empty. There's nothing sacred. Who then are you, said the emperor, to stand before us? I don't know. After this interview, so unsatisfactory from the emperor's point of view, Bodhidharma retired to a monastery in Wei, where he is said to have spent 9 years in a cave gazing at the wall, Bi Guan. Suzuki holds that this is not to be taken literally, and that the expression refers to Bodhidharma's inner state, his exclusion of all grasping thoughts from his mind. Thus Bodhidharma remained until he was approached by the monk Shen Guang, afterwards Wei Ko, 486-593 maybe, who was to become Bodhidharma's successor as the second patriarch. Hui Ko again and again asked Bodhidharma for instruction, but was always refused. Yet he continued to sit in meditation outside the cave, waiting patiently in the snow, in the hope that Bodhidharma would at last relent. In desperation, he finally cut off his left arm, and presented it to Bodhidharma as a token of his agonized sincerity. At this, Bodhidharma at last asked Wei Ko what he wanted. "I have no peace of mind, Shin," said Wei Ko. "Please pacify my mind." "Bring out your mind here before me," replied Bodhidharma, "and I will pacify it." "But when I seek my own mind," said Wei Ko, "I cannot find it." "There," snapped Bodhidharma, "I have pacified your mind." At this moment, Wei Ko had his awakening, his Dunwu or Satori, so that this interchange purports to be the first instance of what became the characteristic Zen method of instruction, the Wenda, Japanese Mondo, or question and answer, sometimes loosely called the Zen story. The greater part of Zen literature consists of these anecdotes, many of them much more puzzling than this, and their aim is always to precipitate some type of sudden realization in the questioner's mind, or to test the depth of his insight. For this reason, such anecdotes cannot be explained without spoiling their effect. In some respects, they are like jokes which do not produce their intended effect of laughter when the punchline requires further explanation. One must see the point immediately, or not at all. It should furthermore be understood that the main character of these anecdotes is only rarely symbolic, and then usually in a rather secondary way, as when the dialogue contains allusions which are obvious to both parties. But such commentators as Jarnet are, I feel, mistaken in supposing that the main point is the communication of some Buddhist principle by means of a symbol. The satori which so frequently follows these interchanges is by no means a mere comprehension of the answer to a riddle, for whatever the Zen master says or does is a direct and spontaneous utterance of suchness, of his Buddha nature, and what he gives is no symbol but the very thing. Zen communication is always direct pointing, in line with the traditional four-phrase summary of Zen: outside teaching, apart from tradition, not founded on words and letters, pointing directly to the human mind, seeing into one's nature, and attaining Buddhahood. Note, in modern Chinese, the first two characters mean something like worldly or outside the fold. In the present context, they are usually taken to mean that the truth of Zen cannot be expressed in any form of doctrine, or that a teacher can do no more than show how to get it for oneself. However, the marvelous ambiguity of Chinese might intentionally allow both meanings. Consider the predominantly secular form of Zen expression and such sayings as, "Wash out your mouth every time you say Buddha." End of note. The successor to Hui Ko is said to have been Seng Tsun, died 606, and the story of their initial interview is of the same form as between Hui Ko and Bodhidharma, except that where Hui Ko asked for peace of mind, Seng Tsun asked to be cleansed of faults. To him there is attributed a celebrated poem called the Xinxing Ming, the treatise on faith in the mind. If Seng Tsun was indeed its author, this poem is the first clear and comprehensive statement of Zen. Its Taoist flavor is apparent in the opening lines: "The perfect Tao is without difficulty, save that it avoids picking and choosing." And again, "Follow your nature and accord with the Tao, saunter along and stop worrying. If your thoughts are tied, you spoil what is genuine. Don't be antagonistic to the world of the senses, for when you are not antagonistic to it, it turns out to be the same as complete awakening. The wise person does not strive, Wu Wei. The ignorant man ties himself up. If you work on your mind with your mind, how can you avoid an immense confusion?" Note, the last two lines carry the same point as Wei Ko's interview with Bodhidharma. End of note. Not only is the poem full of such Taoist terms as Wu Wei and Zhu Run, spontaneity, but its whole attitude is that of letting one's mind alone and trusting it to follow its own nature, in contrast to the more typically Indian attitude of bringing it under rigid control and shutting out the experience of the senses. The fourth patriarch, following Seng Tsun, is believed to have been Dao Xin, 579-651. When he came to Seng Tsun, he asked, What is the method of liberation? Who binds you? Replied Seng-san. No one binds me. Why then, asked Seng-san, should you seek liberation? And this was Dao Xin's Satori. The Zhuang Deng Lu records a fascinating encounter between Dao Xin and the sage Fa Yung, who lived in a lonely temple on Mount Niu Tu, and was so holy that the birds used to bring him offerings of flowers. As the two men were talking, a wild animal roared close by, and Dao Xin jumped. Fa Yung commented, I see it is still with you, referring, of course, to the instinctive passion, klesa, of fright. Shortly afterwards, while he was for a moment unobserved, Dao Xin wrote the Chinese character for Buddha on the rock where Fa Yung was accustomed to sit. When Fa Yung returned to sit down again, he saw the sacred name and hesitated to sit. I see, said Dao Xin, it is still with you. At this remark, Fa Yung was fully awakened, and the birds never brought any more flowers. The fifth patriarch, and here we begin to enter a more reliable chapter of history, was Hung Run, 601 to 675. At his first meeting with Hung Run, the patriarch asked, What is your name? Xing. I have a nature, Xing, replied Hung Run, punning, but it's no usual nature. What is this name? Inquired the patriarch, missing the pun. It's Buddha nature. You have no name, then? That's because it's an empty nature. Hung Run was apparently the first of the patriarchs to have any large following, for it is said that he presided over a group of some 500 monks in a monastery on the Yellow Plum Mountain, Wang Mei Shan, at the eastern end of modern Hubei. He is, however, much overshadowed by his immediate successor, Wei Neng, 637-713, whose life and teaching mark the definitive beginning of a truly Chinese Zen, of Zen as it flourished during what was later called the Epoch of Zen Activity, the latter 200 years of the Tang Dynasty, from about 700 to 906. One must not overlook Wei Neng's contemporaries, for he lived at a time which was most creative for Chinese Buddhism as a whole. The great translator and traveller, Xuan Zang, had returned from India in 645 and was expounding the Vijñaptimātra, representational-only doctrines of the Yogācāra, in Chang'an. His former student, Fa Zhang, 643-712, was developing the important school of the Huayan, Japanese Kegon, based on the Abhatamsaka Sutra, and which later provided Zen with a formal philosophy. Nor must we forget that not so long before these two men, Zhe Kai, 538-597, had written his remarkable treatise on the Mahayana method of cessation and contemplation, containing the fundamental teaching of the Tiantai school, which is in many ways close to Zen. Much of Zhe Kai's treatise foreshadows in both content and terminology the doctrines of Wei Neng and some of his immediate successors. Wei Neng is said to have had his first awakening when, almost as a boy, he happened to overhear someone reading the Vajracchedika. He set out almost at once for Hung Run's monastery at Wang Mei to have his understanding confirmed and to receive further instruction. We should note for future reference that his original Satori occurred spontaneously without the benefit of a master, and that his biography represents him as an illiterate peasant from the neighbourhood of Canton. Apparently, Hung Run immediately recognized the depth of his insight, but fearing that his humble origins might make him unacceptable in a community of scholarly monks, the patriarch put him to work in the kitchen compound. Sometime later, the patriarch announced that he was looking for a successor to whom he might transmit his office, together with the robe and begging bowl said to have been handed down from the Buddha, which were its insignia. This honour was to be conferred upon the person who submitted the best poem, expressing his understanding of Buddhism. The chief monk of the community was then a certain Shen Xu, and all the others naturally assumed that the office would go to him, and so made no attempt to compete. Shen Xu, however, was in doubt as to his own understanding, and decided to submit his poem anonymously, claiming authorship only if the patriarch approved of it. During the night, then, he posted the following lines in the corridor near the patriarch's quarters. The body is the Bodhi tree, the mind like a bright mirror standing. Take care to wipe it all the time, and allow no dust to cling. The following morning the patriarch read the poem and ordered incense to be burned before it, saying that all who put it into practice would be enabled to realize their true nature. But when Shen Xiu came to him in private and claimed authorship, the patriarch declared that his understanding was still far from perfect. On the following day, another poem appeared beside the first. There never was a Bodhi tree, nor bright mirror standing. Fundamentally, not one thing exists. So where is the dust to cling? The patriarch knew that only Hui Neng could have written this, but to avoid jealousy he rubbed out the poem with his shoe and summoned Hui Neng to his room secretly by night. Here he conferred the patriarchate, the robe and the bowl upon him, and told him to flee into the mountains until the hurt feelings of the other monks had subsided and the time was ripe for him to begin his public teaching. A comparison of the two poems shows at once the distinctive flavour of Hui Neng's Zen. Shen Xiu's poem reflects what was apparently the general and popular view of dhyana practice in Chinese Buddhism. It was obviously understood as the discipline of sitting meditation, Dzogchen, in which the mind was purified by an intense concentration which would cause all thoughts and attachments to cease. Taken rather literally, many Buddhist and Taoist texts would substantiate this view that the highest state of consciousness is a consciousness empty of all contents, all ideas, feelings, and even sensations. Today, in India, this is a very prevalent notion of samadhi. But our own experience with Christianity should make this type of literalism, even in high circles, rather familiar. Hui Neng's position was that a man with an empty consciousness was no better than a block of wood or a lump of stone. He insisted that the whole idea of purifying the mind was irrelevant and confusing, because our own nature is fundamentally clear and pure. In other words, there is no analogy between consciousness or mind and a mirror that can be wiped. The true mind is no mind, Wu Xin, which is to say that it is not to be regarded as an object of thought or action, as if it were a thing to be grasped and controlled. The attempt to work on one's own mind is a vicious circle. To try to purify it is to be contaminated with purity. Obviously, this is the Taoist philosophy of naturalness, according to which a person is not genuinely free, detached or pure, when his state is the result of an artificial discipline. He is just imitating purity, just faking clear awareness. Hence the unpleasant self-righteousness of those who are deliberately and methodically religious. Wei Neng's teaching is that instead of trying to purify or empty the mind, one must simply let go of the mind, because the mind is nothing to be grasped. Letting go of the mind is also equivalent to letting go of the series of thoughts and impressions, nian, which come and go in the mind, neither repressing them, holding them, nor interfering with them. Quote, thoughts come and go of themselves, for through the use of wisdom there is no blockage. This is the samadhi of prajna, a natural liberation. Such is the practice of no thought, wu nian. But if you do not think of anything at all, and immediately command thoughts to cease, this is to be tied in a knot by a method, and is called an obtuse view. End of quote. Of the usual view of meditation practice, he said, quote, to concentrate on the mind and to contemplate it until it is still is a disease and not dhyana. To restrain the body by sitting up for a long time, of what benefit is this towards the Dharma? And again, if you start concentrating the mind on stillness, you will merely produce an unreal stillness. What does the word meditation, Dzogchen, mean? In this school it means no barriers, no obstacles. It is beyond all objective situations, whether good or bad. The word sitting, so, means not to stir up thoughts in the mind. End of quote. In counteracting the false dhyana of mere empty-mindedness, Hui Neng compares the great void to space and calls it great not just because it is empty, but because it contains the sun, moon, and stars. True dhyana is to realize that one's own nature is like space, and that thoughts and sensations come and go in this original mind like birds through the sky, leaving no trace. Awakening in his school is sudden because it is for quick-witted rather than slow-witted people. The latter must of necessity understand gradually, or more exactly, after a long time, since the Sixth Patriarch's doctrine does not admit of stages or growth. To be awakened at all is to be awakened completely, for having no parts or divisions, the Buddha nature is not realized bit by bit. His final instructions to his disciples contain an interesting clue to the later development of the Mondo or question-answer method of teaching. If, in questioning you, someone asks about being, answer with non-being. If he asks about non-being, answer with being. If he asks about the ordinary man, answer in terms of the sage. If he asks about the sage, answer in terms of the ordinary man. By this method of opposites, mutually related, there arises an understanding of the middle way. For every question that you are asked, respond in terms of its opposite. Huineng died in 713, and with his death the institution of the patriarchate ceased, for the genealogical tree of Zen put forth branches. Huineng's tradition passed to five disciples. Huai Rong died 775, Qing Yuan died 740, Shen Hui 668 to 770, Xuan Chui 665 to 713, and Hui Chung 677 to 744. The spiritual descendants of Huai Rong and Xing Su live on today as the two principal schools of Zen in Japan, the Rinzai and the Soto. In the two centuries following the death of Huineng, the proliferation of lines of descent and schools of Zen is quite complex, and we need do no more than consider some of the more influential individuals. The writings and records of Huineng's successors continue to be concerned with naturalness. On the principle that the true mind is no mind, and that our true nature is no special nature, it is likewise stressed that the true practice of Zen is no practice, that is, the seeming paradox of being a Buddha without intending to be a Buddha. According to Shen Hui, if one has this knowledge, it is contemplation, samadhi, without contemplating, wisdom, prajna, without wisdom, practice without practicing. All cultivation of concentration is wrong-minded from the start, for how, by cultivating concentration, could one obtain concentration? If we speak of working with the mind, does this working consist in activity or inactivity of the mind? If it is inactivity, we should be no different from vulgar fools. But if you say that it is activity, it is then in the realm of grasping, and we are bound up by the passions, klesa. What way, then, should we have of gaining deliverance? The Sravakas cultivate emptiness, dwell in emptiness, and are bound by it. They cultivate concentration, dwell in concentration, and are bound by it. They cultivate tranquility, dwell in tranquility, and are bound by it. If working with the mind is to discipline one's mind, how could this be called deliverance? End of quote. In the same vein, Xuan Jue begins his celebrated poem, The Song of Realizing the Tao, Cheng Dao Ge. See you not that easy-going man of Tao who has abandoned learning and does not strive? Wu Wei. He neither avoids false thoughts nor seeks the true, for ignorance is in reality the Buddha nature, and this illusory, changeful, empty body is the Dharma body. End of quote. The following story is told of Huai Rong, initiating into Zen his great successor, Ma Zu, died 788, who was at the time practicing sitting meditation at the monastery of Chuan Fa. Your reverence, asked Huai Rong, what is the objective of sitting in meditation? The objective, answered Ma Zu, is to become a Buddha. Thereupon Huai Rong picked up a floor tile and began to polish it on a rock. What are you doing, master? Asked Ma Zu. I am polishing it for a mirror, said Huai Rong. How could polishing a tile make a mirror? How could sitting in meditation make a Buddha? Ma Zu was the first Zen master celebrated for strange words and extraordinary behavior, and is described as one who walked like a bull and glared like a tiger. When a monk asked him, "How do you get into harmony with the Tao?" Matsu replied, "I am already out of harmony with the Tao." He was the first to answer questions about Buddhism by hitting the questioner, or by giving a loud shout, "Hoo!" Sometimes, however, he was more discursive, and one of his lectures takes up the problem of discipline thus. The Tao has nothing to do with discipline. If you say that it is attained by discipline, when the discipline is perfected, it can again be lost. Or, finishing the discipline turns out to be losing the Tao. If you say that there is no discipline, this is to be the same as ordinary people. End of quote. Xing Su's disciple, She Tu, 700-790, in the line of Soto Zen, was even more forthright. "My teaching, which has come down from the ancient Buddhas, is not dependent on meditation, dhyana, or on diligent application of any kind. When you attain the insight as attained by the Buddha, you realize that mind is Buddha and Buddha is mind. That mind, Buddha, sentient beings, body and klesa, are of one and the same substance, while they vary in names." End of quote. His interesting name, Stonehead, is attributed to the fact that he lived on top of a large rock near the monastery of Hengju. With Mazu's disciple, Nan Chuan, 748-834, and his successor, Zhao Zhu, 778-897, the teaching of Zen became peculiarly lively and disturbing. The Wu Men Guan tells how Nan Chuan interrupted a dispute among his monks as to the ownership of a cat by threatening to cleave the animal with his spade if none of the monks could say a good word, that is, give an immediate expression of his Zen. There was dead silence. So the master cut the cat in two. Later in the day, Nan Chuan recounted the incident to Zhao Zhu, who at once put his shoes on his head and left the room. "If you had been here," said Nan Chuan, "the cat would have been saved." Zhao Zhu is said to have had his awakening after the following incident with Nan Chuan. Zhao Zhu asked, "What is the Tao?" The master replied, "Your ordinary, that is, natural, mind is the Tao. How can one return into accord with it?" "By intending to accord, you immediately deviate." "But without intention, how can one know the Tao?" "The Tao," said the master, "belongs neither to knowing nor not knowing. Knowing is false understanding. Not knowing is blind ignorance. If you really understand the Tao beyond doubt, it's like the empty sky. Why drag in right and wrong?" When Zhao Zhu was asked whether a dog has Buddha nature, which is certainly the usual Mahayana doctrine, he gave the one word, "no," wu, Japanese mu. When a monk asked him for instruction, he merely inquired whether he had eaten his gruel, and then added, "Go wash your bowl." When asked about the spirit which remains when the body has decomposed, he remarked, "This morning, it's windy again." Matsu had another notable disciple in Bo Zheng, 720-814, who is said to have organized the first purely Zen community of monks and to have laid down its regulations on the principle that a day of no working is a day of no eating. Since his time, a strong emphasis on manual work and some degree of self-support has been characteristic of Zen communities. It might be remarked here that these are not exactly monasteries in the Western sense. They are rather training schools from which one is free to depart at any time without censure. Some members remain monks for their whole lives, others become secular priests in charge of small temples, still others may return into lay life. Note, the somewhat misleading word monk seems to be the inevitable translation of Seng, though Yun Shui, cloud and water, is a common and revealingly picturesque term for the Zen student, who drifts like a cloud and flows like water, that I am at a loss to find a concise English expression for this term. End of note. To Bo Zheng is attributed the famous definition of Zen, when hungry eat, when tired sleep. He is said to have had his satori when Matsu shouted at him and left him deaf for 3 days, and to have been in the habit of pointing out the Zen life to his disciples with the saying, "Don't cling, don't seek." For when asked about seeking for the Buddha nature, he answered, "It's much like riding an ox in search of the ox." Bo Zheng's student, Huang Bo, died 850, is also of considerable importance in this period. Not only was he the teacher of the great Lin Ji, but he was also the author of the Chuan Xin Fa Yao, or Treatise on the Essentials of the Doctrine of Mind. The content of this work is essentially the same body of doctrine as is found in Hui Neng, Shen Hui, and Ma Zhu, but it contains some passages of remarkable clarity, as well as some frank and careful answers to questions at the end. Quote, "By their very seeking for it, the Buddha nature, they produce the contrary effect of losing it, for that is using the Buddha to seek for the Buddha, and using mind to grasp mind. Even though they do their utmost for a full kalpa, they will not be able to attain to it. If those who study the Tao do not awake to this mind substance, they will create a mind over and above mind, seek the Buddha outside themselves, and remain attached to forms, practices and performances, all of which is harmful, and not the way to supreme knowledge." End of quote. Much of it is devoted to a clarification of what is meant by the void, and by the terms no mind, wu xin, and no thought, wu nian, all of which are carefully distinguished from literal blankness or nothingness. The use of Taoist language and ideas is found throughout the text. Quote, "Fearing that none of you would understand, they, the Buddhas, gave it the name Tao, but you must not base any concept upon that name. So it is said that when the fish is caught, the trap is forgotten." From Chuangzu. "When body and mind achieve spontaneity, the Tao is reached and universal mind can be understood. In former times, men's minds were sharp. Upon hearing a single sentence, they abandoned study and so came to be called the sages who, abandoning learning, rest in spontaneity. In these days, people only seek to stuff themselves with knowledge and deductions, placing great reliance on written explanations and calling all this the practice." End of quote. It appears, however, that Huang Bo's personal instruction of his disciples was not always so explanatory. Lin Ji, Japanese Rinzai, died 867, could never get a word out of him. Every time he attempted to ask a question, Huang Bo struck him, until in desperation he left the monastery and sought the advice of another master, Da Yu, who scolded him for being so ungrateful for Huang Bo's grandmotherly kindness. This awakened Lin Ji, who again presented himself before Huang Bo. This time, however, it was Lin Ji who did the striking, saying, "There is not much in Huang Bo's Buddhism after all." The record of Lin Ji's teaching, the Lin Ji Lu, Japanese Rinzai Roku, shows a character of immense vitality and originality, lecturing his students in informal and often somewhat racy language. It is as if Lin Ji were using the whole strength of his personality to force the student into immediate awakening. Again and again he berates them for not having enough faith in themselves, for letting their minds gallop around in search of something which they have never lost, and which is right before you at this very moment. Awakening for Lin Ji seems primarily a matter of nerve, the courage to let go without further delay in the unwavering faith that one's natural, spontaneous functioning is the Buddha mind. His approach to conceptual Buddhism, to the student's obsession with stages to be reached and goals to be attained, is ruthlessly iconoclastic. Quote, "Why do I talk here? Only because you followers of the Tao go galloping around in search of the mind and are unable to stop it. On the other hand, the ancients acted in a leisurely way, appropriate to circumstances as they arose. Oh, you followers of the Tao, when you get my point of view, you will sit in judgment on top of the Buddha's heads. Those who have completed the 10 stages will seem like underlings, and those who have arrived at supreme awakening will seem as if they had kangs around their necks. The Arhans and Pratyeka Buddhas are like a dirty privy. Bodhi and Nirvana are like hitching posts for a donkey." End of quote. On the importance of the natural or unaffected Wu She life, he is especially emphatic. "There is no place in Buddhism for using effort. Just be ordinary and nothing special. Relieve your bowels, pass water, put on your clothes, and eat your food. When you're tired, go and lie down. Ignorant people may laugh at me, but the wise will understand. As you go from place to place, if you regard each one as your own home, they will all be genuine, for when circumstances come, you must not try to change them. Thus your usual habits of feeling, which make karma for the five hells, will of themselves become the great ocean of liberation. End of quote. And on creating karma through seeking liberation, outside the mind there is no dharma, and inside also there is nothing to be grasped. What is it that you seek? You say on all sides that the Tao is to be practiced and put to the proof. Don't be mistaken. If there is anyone who can practice it, this is entirely karma making for birth and death. You talk about being perfectly disciplined in your six senses and in the 10,000 ways of conduct, but as I see it, all this is creating karma. To seek the Buddha and to seek the Dharma is precisely making karma for the hells. End of quote. In Mazu, Nanchuan, Zhaozhou, Huangbo, and Linji, we can see the flavor of Zen at its best. Taoist and Buddhist, as it is in its original inspiration, it is also something more. It is so earthy, so matter-of-fact, and so direct. The difficulty of translating the records of these masters is that their style of Chinese is neither classical nor modern, but rather the colloquial speech of the Tang dynasty. Its naturalness is less refined, less obviously beautiful than that of the Taoist sages and poets. It is almost rough and common. I say almost because the expression is not really correct. We are at a loss for parallels from other cultures for comparison, and the Western student can best catch its flavor through observing the works of art which it was subsequently to inspire. The best image might be a garden, consisting of no more than an expanse of raked sand as a ground for several unhewn rocks overgrown with lichens and moss, such as one may see today in the Zen temples of Kyoto. The media are the simplest imaginable. The effect is as if man had hardly touched it, as if it had been transported unchanged from the seashore. But in practice, only the most sensitive and experienced artist can achieve it. This sounds, of course, as though Zen flavor were a studied and affected primitivism. Sometimes it is. But the genuine Zen flavor is when a man is almost miraculously natural, without intending to be so. His Zen life is not to make himself, but to grow that way. Thus it should be obvious that the naturalness of these Tang masters is not to be taken just literally, as if Zen were merely to glory in being a completely ordinary vulgar fellow who scatters ideals to the wind and behaves as he pleases, for this would in itself be an affectation. The naturalness of Zen flourishes only when one has lost affectedness and self-consciousness of every description. But a spirit of this kind comes and goes like the wind, and is the most impossible thing to institutionalize and preserve. Yet in the late Tang dynasty, the genius and vitality of Zen was such that it was coming to be the dominant form of Buddhism in China, though its relation to other schools was often very close. Sung Mi, 779 to 841, was simultaneously a Zen master and the fifth patriarch of the Huaiyan school, representing the philosophy of the Abhidhammasaka Sutra. This extremely subtle and mature form of Mahayana philosophy was employed by Tung Shan, 807 to 869, in developing the doctrine of the five ranks, Wu Wei, concerning the fivefold relationship of the absolute, Zheng, and the relative, Pian, and was related by his student, Cao Shan, 840 to 901, to the philosophy of the Yi Jing, the Book of Changes. Fa Yen, 885 to 958, and Fen Yang, 947 to 1024, were also influential masters who made a deep study of the Hua Yen, and to this day it constitutes, as it were, the intellectual aspect of Yen. On the other hand, such masters as De Zhao, 891 to 972, and Yen Shu, 904 to 975, maintained close relations with the Tian Tai and Pure Land schools. In 845, there was a brief but vigorous persecution of Buddhism by the Taoist emperor Wu Zung. Temples and monasteries were destroyed, their lands confiscated, and the monks compelled to return to lay life. Fortunately, his enthusiasm for Taoist alchemy soon involved him in experiments with the elixir of immortality, and from partaking of this concoction he shortly died. Zen had survived the persecution better than any other school, and now entered into a long era of imperial and popular favor. Hundreds of monks thronged its wealthy monastic institutions, and the fortunes of the school so prospered, and its numbers so increased, that the preservation of its spirit became a very serious problem. Popularity almost invariably leads to a deterioration of quality, and as Zen became less of an informal spiritual movement and more of a settled institution, it underwent a curious change of character. It became necessary to standardize its methods and to find means for the masters to handle students in large numbers. There were also the special problems which arise for monastic communities when their membership increases. Their traditions harden, and their novices tend more and more to be mere boys without natural vocation, sent for training by their pious families. The effect of this last factor upon the development of institutional Zen can hardly be underestimated. For the Zen community became less an association of mature men with spiritual interests and more of an ecclesiastical boarding school for adolescent boys. Under such circumstances, the problem of discipline became paramount. The Zen masters were forced to concern themselves not only with the way of liberation from convention, but also with the instilling of convention, of ordinary manners and morals in raw youths. The mature Western student who discovers an interest in Zen as a philosophy or as a way of liberation must be careful to keep this in mind, for otherwise he may be unpleasantly startled by monastic Zen as it exists today in Japan. He will find that Zen is a discipline enforced with the big stick. He will find that although it is still an effective way of liberation, at its upper end, its main preoccupation is with a disciplinary regimen which trains character, in the same way as the old-fashioned British public school or the Jesuit novitiate. But it does the job remarkably well. The Zen type is an extremely fine type as types go, self-reliant, humorous, clean, and orderly to a fault, energetic though unhurried, and hard as nails, without lack of keen aesthetic sensibility. The general impression of these men is that they have the same sort of balance as the Daruma doll. They are not rigid, but no one can knock them down. Still another crucial problem arises when a spiritual institution comes into prosperity and power, the very human problem of competition for office and of who has the right to be a master. Concern for this problem is reflected in the writing of the Chuan Deng Lu, or record of the transmission of the lamp, by Dao Yuan in about 1004. For one of the main objects of this work was to establish a proper apostolic succession for the Zen tradition, so that no one could claim authority unless his satori had been approved by someone who had been approved right back to the time of the Buddha himself. Nothing, however, is more difficult than establishing proper qualifications in the imponderable realm of spiritual insight. Where the candidates are few, the problem is not so grave, but where one master is responsible for some hundreds of students, the process of teaching and testing requires standardization. Zen solved this problem with remarkable ingenuity, employing a means which not only provided a test of competence, but, what was much more, a means of transmitting the Zen experience itself with a minimum of falsification. This extraordinary invention was the system of the Gong-an, Japanese koan, or Zen problem. Literally, this term means a public document or case, in the sense of a decision creating a legal precedent. Thus the koan system involves passing a series of tests based on the mondo or anecdotes of the old masters. One of the beginning koans is Zhao Zhu's answer, wu or no, to the question as to whether a dog has Buddha nature. The student is expected to show that he has experienced the meaning of the koan by a specific and usually non-verbal demonstration which he has to discover intuitively. The period of prosperity which came with the 10th and 11th centuries was attended by a sense of loss of spirit, which in turn gave rise to much study of the great Tang masters. Their anecdotes were subsequently collected in such anthologies as the Bi Yen Lu, 1125, and the Wu Men Guan, 1229. The use of these anecdotes for the koan method was originated by Yuan Wu, 1063 to 1135, and his disciple Da Hui, 1089 to 1163, in the 10th or 11th generation of descent from Lin Ji. However, something which already began to resemble it was employed by Huang Lung, 1002 to 1069, in order to cope with his particularly large following. He devised three test questions known as Huang Lung's Three Barriers. Question: everybody has a place of birth. Where is your place of birth? Answer: early this morning I ate white rice gruel. Now I'm hungry again. Question: how is my hand like the Buddha's hand? Answer: playing the lute under the moon. Question: how is my foot like a donkey's foot? Answer: when the white heron stands in the snow, it has a different color. No doubt the answers given were the original replies to the questions, but later the problem becomes both the question and its answer, for the student is expected to see into the relationship between the two, which, to say the least, is none too obvious. For the moment, it is enough to say that every koan has a point, which is some aspect of Zen experience, that its point is often concealed by being made very much more apparent than one would expect, and that koans are concerned not only with the primary awakening to the void, but also with its subsequent expression in life and thought. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.